What if, just like a certain unnamed celebrity, we could consciously uncouple the economy from the fight against climate change? What do you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 8th of August. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Dateline, Bedminster, New Jersey, this afternoon. Headline, a presidential briefing session on the opioid crisis. A report from a commission that President Trump set up to study that crisis cited data showing the number of overdoses in the United States from drugs like Percocet and OxyContin have quadrupled since 1999. Getting the money necessary to fight that crisis, though, has been tough and may not be getting any easier. Marketplace's Annie Baxter gets us going.
National public health emergencies are typically declared for things like Zika outbreaks and Ebola emergency responses. That's according to Richard Frank, a health economics professor at Harvard University.
What's different here is the opioid epidemic is this chronic problem that has been long in the making and, in fact, is sort of going to be long in finding a solution.
Last year, President Obama signed the 21st Century Cures Act. It gives states $1 billion in grants over 2 years to address the opioid problem, providing for things like prescription drug monitoring and addiction prevention programs. But Frank says that was a small investment. He says the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act has been more beneficial in fighting the growing opioid crisis.
The Medicaid expansion is a critical tool, and I estimated that about $5.5 billion was spent on substance use treatment.
He says it helped pay for things like the opioid overdose reversal drug Naloxone. Republicans, including President Trump, want to repeal the ACA and shrink Medicaid. But in a nod to the severity of the opioid problem, a revised version of the health care bill introduced in June called for $45 billion to go to states for the crisis. The measure failed, and some senators thought the amount wasn't high enough. Jim Blumenstock with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials says there are ways to help besides funding, which an emergency declaration could provide.
Such as waiving standards or regulations that are not applicable in a time of crisis.
The Opioid Crisis Commission recommended waiving a rule limiting the use of Medicaid funds for certain residential addiction facilities. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The White House has until next week to finish reviewing an interagency climate report, but the news really is out already. A draft of the scientific portion of what is called the National Climate Assessment was leaked to the New York Times today. The report states that climate change is happening, that humans are causing it, and that there will be dire consequences for the United States as a result. Among the report's findings is this Marketplace tidbit that fighting climate change does not have to mean cutting economic growth. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim explains.
Your word of the day is decoupling. See, once it appeared gospel that in order to grow our economy, you had to emit carbon. Factories burn coal, trucks burn fuel, all in order to allow us to increase our productivity. Nowadays, though, natural gas and renewable power has upset that dogma.
We can have it both ways, and growth can occur as we clean up the economy.
Mark Muro is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says 33 states have now effectively decoupled their GDP growth from carbon.
So we've seen a true inflection point in the history of economies and emissions.
And the rate at which we're decoupling has picked up steam. But that doesn't mean it can't be slowed or even reversed, says Josh Bivens. He's research director at the Nonpartisan Economic Policy Institute.
We absolutely could see emissions and growth start to move together again in a destructive way.
That would depend on policies enacted at the federal level, ones, for instance, that would favor the return of coal power to dominance. In the draft of the federal climate report, scientists say decoupling is happening and it's helping slow down climate change, but
there's nothing automatic that is going to translate this report into more aggressive climate policy.
And policy has a very big role in whether emissions get reduced.
My read is it's impossible to reach beneficial climate goals without policy.
Michael Greenstone is a University of Chicago economist. He gets annoyed when too much attention gets paid to decoupling.
Relying on market forces can help to reduce emissions, but it won't deliver the protection from climate change that the best evidence suggests is necessary.
He says it's not just about improving the ratio of GDP to carbon. He says to stave off disaster, we'll need to reduce emissions drastically, no matter the cost. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
If you're a big company in this economy, you're doing all right. Profits are good. The big picture economy is strong enough and job creation is pretty solid. For startups, though, it's the other way around. Startup activity overall is down by about half from the 1980s. That's according to the Kauffman Foundation. And a Federal Reserve Bank of New York study out today highlights some of the problems that startups are having getting financing. And here is the why it matters line. According to the New York Fed, startups account for, and this is a quote, nearly all net new job creation in the U.S. economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman unpacks that one.
Startup businesses, especially high-growth startups that plan to enter a new market or disrupt an existing one, are the engines of economic expansion in the U.S., says Claire Kramer-Mills at the New York Fed.
Startups play a really outsized role in the U.S. economy. They have generated nearly all net job creation, and they play a vital role in innovation.
The Kauffman Foundation has crunched the employment numbers. VP for Entrepreneurship Victor Wang says big legacy companies do create jobs, but they also hit a certain size and stop growing, or downsize and close plants.
The big businesses tend to be more stable. They don't tend to create the number of jobs that you really need.
Whereas the highest growth startups in their first 5 years are responsible for most of the net employment increase, explains Jeffrey Soule at the University of New Hampshire Center for Venture Research. He says those startups
start small but are adding jobs and creating wealth and scaling up to increasing their market share. So those are the real job generators.
Rana Lustian's new business is one of them. She's a former pastry chef, and her four-year-old L.A.-based dessert company is called Edible, with gourmet cookie dough in groceries in California and Texas, and three employees so far.
We're still running the business pretty lean, but we're looking to grow our team.
One thing she's not looking for yet, outside bank or investor financing. That's something the New York Fed report says many startups struggle to get.
Raising money is a full-time job, and I haven't quite been able to manage running the business and going out there and raising money.
And for startups to generate jobs and grow, experts say access to capital needs to be in the mix. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The big corporate news today came after the closing bell when the Walt Disney Company made its quarterly earnings announcement. The entertainment conglomerate didn't make quite as much money as everybody had been guessing. But here's the real news. CEO Bob Iger announced Disney is going to pull its movies from Netflix in 2019, start up its own streaming service. Netflix shares after hours down almost 3%. So listen, when your kids ask you when Wall Street stopped taking Washington seriously, you can tell them it was today. President Trump, at that opioid event in New Jersey this afternoon, had this to say about North Korea and new reports it can now put nuclear weapons on its intercontinental ballistic missiles. Here you go.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Traders heard that, basically shrugged the major indices off a remarkably small 0.2%. We will have the details when we do the numbers. If you flip on the TV or you pull out your phone, and assuming you pay attention to the ads at all, you might notice a certain overlap of late between stories in the news and the ads that punctuate them about the sometimes tricky social and political issues right now in this economy. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has this look at global brands trying to align themselves with consumers' values on the way to their pocketbooks.
A mother and daughter sit in the front seat of a parked car.
Now, when you get pulled over...
I'm a good driver.
Okay? Baby,
don't worry.
This is not about you getting a ticket. This is about you not coming home.
This is a new ad from Procter & Gamble. Part of its My Black is Beautiful campaign.
Right?
It shows a series of conversations between black mothers and their children.
You are not pretty for a black girl. You are beautiful, period. Okay?
Every mom has the birds and the bees talk, but there was a very specific conversation that African-American mothers have had over decades. So from the 50s to today, that is the same conversation.
Christine Decker is P&G's Director of North American Marketing. She says this is the latest in a string of socially conscious ads from P&G. Over the last couple of years, the company estimates it's spent hundreds of millions of dollars across a handful of different campaigns that all address bias issues. After it tested this ad in a few small TV markets, it spread through social media, racking up about 5 million views in just 10 days. P&G still hasn't done a major TV campaign with it yet, but the company has found these ads work. A female empowerment campaign a few years ago from its Always brand of feminine products helped that business increase its market share by 2 percentage points.
Everybody makes good, useful stuff now. And it's all, you know, one click away on Amazon.com.
Jim Nail with Forrester Research says making something that is fundamentally different and better from what everyone else is making, it's hard.
And if you manage to do it briefly, you will be copied and you'll have a raft of competitors in very short order.
So he sees an increasing number of big brands trying to connect with consumers by using this type of advertising. Ones that pitch a common set of values or focus on a societal issue like race, gender, or inequality.
It's been a long time coming.
Opportunity should not discriminate. The ball should bounce the same for everyone.
That was a Nike ad. Heineken had a spot where strangers with opposing beliefs were paired up and given the option to talk through their differences over, yes, a beer.
Well, I'm having a drink.
I'm having a drink.
Yeah.
Beer.
Yeah, beer and discuss.
Of course, inserting your brand into sensitive and difficult conversations is risky. Companies can alienate consumers who disagree with the message of the ad, or they can just miss the mark. Remember that ad Pepsi pulled this spring after a big public backlash? It featured model Kendall Jenner leaving a photo shoot to join a group of protesters marching in the street. Then she hands a police officer a Pepsi while the protesters cheer. Here's Forrester's Jim Nail again.
Pepsi tried to make their product the solution to the, you know, the strife between the races.
Which is pretty cringy. On the other hand, Nail says Heineken positioned itself as more of a facilitator, helping people have difficult conversations.
So it took more of a side role as opposed to, you know, the classic advertising approach is to make the product the hero.
He says for this type of advertising to work, the product has to get out of the way. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
No matter what the headline numbers say, a decent to, in some ways, pretty good economy doesn't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy mixed-up world unless people are feeling it in their everyday lives. That's the idea behind our series, My Economy. You tell us your economic story, we put it on the radio. Today's dispatch is about something we all need and use every day, but probably don't think about too much. Here you go.
My name is Jean Sabin, and I'm from Sacramento, California. I run wastewater treatment plants. I was going through my bachelor's during the recession, during the worst parts of the recession. If there's one thing I learned while I was at school, it was that the assumed constants can always change. So I knew that I wanted a job that I enjoyed, but would always have job security. It gave me the economic base to take a risk. I quit my beautiful full-time job and went to the bottom of the world. I worked at McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Something that really struck me is there's a walking trail out to Hut Point. You can look back and see the wastewater treatment plant, and you can only hear two things. It's the wind over the ice and the blowers from the wastewater treatment plant. So, I mean, there's Weddell seals out there on the ice, but like, I will always have a job. Wherever I go, I can walk up to a wastewater plant anywhere in the world and tell them, hey, I'm a certified grade 5 wastewater operator in California. I'm good. I can run this plant. Just like the children's book, Everyone Poops. It's definitely the ultimate in job security.
Jean Sabin, she's back home in much warmer Sacramento, California now. Those were actual Waddell seals, by the way. Take a second. Tell us about your economy. There's a place you can do that, marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
Yeah, we are kind of the Match.com of intergenerational home sharing.
Baby boomers renting rooms to millennials. But first, let's do the numbers. Fire and fury in a down Wall Street. Dow Industrials broke its 10-day winning streak, shed a 10%, about 33 points, 22,085. NASDAQ dipped 0.2%, 13.6370. The S&P 500 also gave back 0.2%, about 5 points. Finished things at 24.74. Financial stocks took the down elevator. J.P. Morgan Chase gave back 0.3%. Morgan Stanley unloaded about 0.7%. Bank of America down about 0.25%. Uncertainty helped keep healthcare stocks adrift. Aetna down 0.4%. Cigna reversed 0.2%. Johnson & Johnson forfeited 0.4%. Today, bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.29%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Economic indicators come in all shapes and sizes. Today, they're in the form of washers and dryers. The Census Bureau says the number of laundry facilities in this country, that is mostly laundromats, has dropped almost 20% since 2005, mostly in big cities where there are more would-be needed customers there. It's a story of changing urban landscapes told by Oakland-based Mark Verabedian for The Atlantic Magazine. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Kai. Thanks. Great to be here.
Why are we seeing this decline in laundromats? What's going on?
We're really seeing it focused around big, dense cities that are seeing a sudden influx of wealth. As developers sweep through these previously gritty, dense urban neighborhoods that are dominated by renters, you know, the first thing they do is they put in apartments and housing with washer and dryer hookups.
This is a little bit of false romanticism, right? But it's part of a change in this society. I mean, there's something to be, not that hauling your laundry down to the laundromat to get it done for, you know, 10 or 15 bucks is fun, but there's something to be said for that, you know, the way it's changing neighborhoods to not have these places there.
Laundromats have been a long time urban staple, and it's funny, the pop culture depictions of laundromats is very present in a lot of people's minds. You know, Seinfeld spun an episode around a laundromat. There's a kind of a classic 1985 film called The Laundromat, and you're right. I mean, they're kind of one of the few places where people from very different walks of life get thrust together. And, you know, I think losing that, sure, there's maybe a bit of false nostalgia about it.
Not to get all personal finance about this, but washing your laundry in a laundromat can get expensive. You got a family of four or five, and it's probably $100.
Yeah, a lot of the laundromats around here, you know, you're looking at $4.50 to $5 a wash. And if you've got a big family, that's over $100 a month easy. So
Is that $4.50 or $5 wash and dry, or is it $5 to wash and $5 to dry? As you can tell, I haven't been to a laundromat in a good long while.
That's $4.50 to $5 just for the wash.
Wow.
Drying is usually a bit cheaper, but still, that adds up.
Some of these laundromat owners, you say in this piece, are, if they can't sort of turn their buildings into something else, they're dressing up the laundromats themselves, right? They're doing Wi-Fi and all kinds of different things.
Yeah, there's this movement to make the laundromat more hip, which is kind of funny in itself.
Yeah.
The coin laundry industry, they have a conference every other year in Las Vegas. And one of the talking points this year was, you know, how can we make laundromats more appealing to young people where they want to hang out and, you know, meet other people. And so they're trying to flip the script on laundromat. You know, it's kind of been viewed as this downtrodden eyesore within the community. And the industry's kind of trying to shift that image.
It has to be said here that there are people in this economy who need the laundromats, whose landlords are not going to put in the plumbing and electrical fixtures to get them washers and dryers, and who depend on these places that are now going away.
The numbers are shrinking, particularly in neighborhoods that are seeing an influx of wealth. But sure, there's still tons of people that depend on laundromats. So that demand will still be there, I think. And, you know, some of the people that I talked to said laundromats closing in their community makes them have to work harder to do their laundry. They got to walk further. They maybe have to go to a more expensive one, that kind of thing.
Mark Vardabedian, he writes on laundromats for The Atlantic just now. Mark, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Guy. Great to be on the show.
Housing gets a fair amount of airtime on this program because it's the housing market, of course. One of the key features of American residential real estate the past five or so years has been that prices are high and inventory is low. That is certainly the case in big cities, which, as it happens, is where the jobs are. It's not great news for people just joining the workforce, trying to get ahead while also trying to put a roof over their heads. Well, there's some new research out from the real estate firm Trulia that points to a possible solution: baby boomers. Marketplace's Adam Allington has more on that.
Trulia found that in the 100 largest metro areas, Americans 53 and older are sitting on some 3.6 million unoccupied rooms in their homes, rooms they could rent to help ease the current housing shortage.
The housing market pressure on both older Americans and younger Americans is ratcheting up right now.
David Widener is the managing editor for economic research at Trulia. He says since the housing bottom just 5 years ago, rental costs have risen between 25% and 50%. And for cash-strapped millennials, renting a room as opposed to, say, a one-bedroom apartment could save them thousands of dollars annually.
It's pretty hard to turn down, say, $14,000 in savings a year by simply renting out a room from, you know, a baby boomer. And likewise, for the baby boomer, it's hard to turn that money down when you're looking at the costs of owning and maintaining a home going up every year.
Dale Manti and his wife Liz live in a big five-bedroom house in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. He jokes that they started renting rooms out to younger people to help cope with their newfound empty nest.
To just make sure that we didn't overly focus on our own kids, that we would like spend our parental nudging energy on somebody else.
Liz says it's nice to have someone there to help water the plants or take care of the pets when they're not at home, and the $700 rent really does add up.
It helps a little bit to have that little extra cash every month. And our house sort of begs to have people in it because it's sort of empty with just two people.
By 2030, the proportion of Americans over 65 is expected to swell to 20%. That's a lot of people. It could also be a highly lucrative business opportunity.
Welcome to Nesterly, the online community where homeowners with spare bedrooms can connect with students willing to do household tasks in exchange for affordable rents.
Noelle Marcus and Rachel Gore are urban planners who recently graduated from MIT.
Yeah, we are kind of the Match.com of intergenerational home sharing.
Together, Marcus and Gore co-founded Nesterly, an app that matches aging homeowners with grad students, something in high demand in a city like Boston, a place with lots of students and sky-high rents.
In some ways, you could consider it effectively creating new units at no additional cost.
Nesterly is scheduled for a beta launch in Boston next month. New York University is also rolling out a similar program in 2018. And while it's not exactly the kind of independent lifestyle most young people dream of, increasingly, Gore says, it's one people are willing to accept.
The opportunity to have this lower rent, even if maybe you have a little more restrictions on your social life, we think that the trade-offs are actually pretty low, and that's what we've heard from the people we've spoken to.
Housing consultant Anna Marie Pluhar says the differences between boomers and millennials are often exaggerated, and the benefits of intergenerational housing are greater than simple economics.
Friendship, companionship. For instance, the benefit of having somebody around who says, "How was your day?" It lifts your heart.
According to Trulia's data, the area around Washington, D.C. ranks highest in supply of spare rooms, but San Francisco's the most expensive, where an extra room can generate around $22,000 per year. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a follow-up of sorts in which my mother and many, many, many others of you took issue with my interview yesterday about the American check-writing economy in this age of Venmo and digital payments. Quote, in an email from my mother last night, "So, Kai, I and my generation are the cause of keeping the U.S. in the dark ages. Love you anyway, Mom." All right, we got to go. The Dow broke its 10-day winning streak today, down about a 10%, 33 points. NASDAQ off 0.2%, 13 points. S&P 500 also down 0.2%, 5 points. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.